Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for joining me for the live broadcast of the June 16th, 2014 edition of The Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I have several topics to discuss, and although they are related, they're not exactly the same, and I've had trouble coming up with a satisfactory title for this program, as well as a picture. Sometimes I really spend or waste a lot of time fussing over this particular, whether a title or a picture. And I was working on this right before the show, I think I decided on what picture I'll use. So, okay, when the show's over. So thanks to, I want to give thanks to some, to my contributors again, and especially tonight to Dimitar, who contributes every month. He's like an old friend. I would like to meet him sometime because he really is like an old friend. And I've conversed with him just a little bit by email. But I think he's been contributing to me regularly since I didn't go back and check, but I was thinking about it, and like at least 2 years, and heck, maybe even three. That's a long time. He sent me a beautiful book one time, a big picture book on Jews. It's full of information. I should get it out and do some shows based on it. I've always thought I would do that. I did one time. I did use it a couple of times. Came in real handy. But then I want to bring up again Ron in Colorado, who I mentioned on Saturday. I had just seen his donation, and it was, more generous than most that one gets, and I was kind of excited about it because I didn't remember seeing his name before, but he may have contributed before. But I wrote to him and thanked him, and then he wrote back to me, had some interesting things to say, and I don't really want to reveal them, but he has given money to people in this movement, particularly looks like people in radio, and he's not always been happy with the results. So there's two instances here he mentioned, and where people drop out. And basically what happened was that they dropped out, they didn't keep going. And he does say that at the end here, he's learned his lesson about donating money to hobbyists, and he's in it for the long term, and he thinks that I am too. Well, I guess I am. I don't think I'm going anywhere. But it is true that people are full of enthusiasm, and the next thing you know, they're gone. So, and when you've been giving money, you know, it's hard. I'll just say a little bit about this because I have, over the period of time I've been involved in this, wanted to donate money to help, and I was looking for somebody, and sometimes I thought this is a good place to donate money. I'm sure many people have had this same experience. And then I never, of course, gave any huge amount, but so it didn't bother me any. It was kind of like a lesson. After a while, I would change my mind about that person for I thought what I thought were good reasons, and then I thought, well, I'm glad I never gave any more than I did, because I didn't want to give money to him anymore. And I've even wanted to give larger amounts of money or leave money and things like that to somebody, you know, that would someplace. I'm still looking for someplace to leave money to in my will and so on that I think would be worthwhile. And I'm telling you, I have not been able to come up with anyone or anything. I've always thought, well, Carolyn, put everything you've got in what you're doing. But I can only put so much into that. I mean, I can only do, and I, you know, you need your money to live on. So a lot of people do leave money in their will, and I don't know what happens to it. I don't think anything very good. I don't, you know, you never see anything, any of this money being used for something. And I know people do leave money, and I can't, it's very disappointing, the track record of, whether it's kind of like white nationalism, or whether it's Holocaust revisionism, which I care a lot about, or things like national socialist groups or something, but I don't like any of those. Too many of them, they have to keep kind of quiet because you know, they can't do much. It's a problem with actually supporting, in particularly in any larger way, people doing things in this movement that you think is gonna really, your money's gonna go for something substantial, something positive and lasting. All right, so tonight I'm going to be talking about race and ethnicity amongst us. As I say us, those of you who are listening and will be listening, I mean, I don't know what else to say, but us, there's an awful lot of talk about race, you know, like my race is my religion, race comes first, white race unite, et cetera. But we don't line up according to race, and we cannot line up according to race because there are more powerful issues than race. That's what I see. Even though people don't think it, people think that we can line up according to race, and people think that we're united by race and joined by race. But I say that there's two things that are more powerful than that in people's motivations, and they are, one, religion, and two, politics or ideology. Throughout history, we existed predominantly among people of our own race. Our race was dominant in where we lived. So our race was a given thing. It was just given. It was not something we had to defend or concern ourselves with. There were the times of fighting against the Turks and the Muslims and so on. But other than that, we were pretty self-sufficient. This is really important to acknowledge when trying to accomplish something in the field of revisionism, and in seeking to establish historical truth in any area. Holocaust truth has become a very large segment of historical truth in our time. Those who say that let's work on advancing our race as a race and leave revisionism out of it. I'm thinking of certain people when I say that who have put that forth in the past and still are. Well, those people find that religion and political ideology and therefore the historical record do get in the way. I'm going to start out tonight by looking at some differences among Europeans between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, because a person named Marcus, who is a regular listener to my programs, asked the question on my website this past week. He said this, for a future show, could you list any Russian, Czech, or Polish revisionists, if there are any? I observe that when French, British, American, or Westerners in general learned the truth about Hitler, they changed their entire worldview. While many Easterners do not, but only marginalize it, slightly. Well, I thought that was brought up something that's very true. Who are the revisionists, and are there any revisionists from these countries? And I found that there weren't, although I'm told there's one or two, and I did discover one. This might be the one that this person meant, but he couldn't come up with his name at the moment. But he was only partially, you know, he didn't want to be called a denier. But there's a lot of regular revisionists that people think of as revisionists who also insist that they don't deny the Holocaust. I'll get into that a little bit, because that is something that I have a strong opinion about, and I don't think it makes any sense to say I don't deny the Holocaust and still be a Holocaust revisionist. Because, as we know, the Holocaust, and then they'll use the term the Holocaust has a certain meaning. You know, it means certain things. It means that 6 million, and it means that there is a plan to kill all these all the Jews, if possible, that existed in the world, and then it means that what's the other part of it? That there was a plan, and that they were killed in, that there were gas chambers. And people will say, well, I don't believe in the gas chambers. All right, fine, but then if they still kind of believe the rest or partially, well, then they call that the Holocaust. And I think people who are really revisionists should say, I don't deny that there was a Holocaust, but they shouldn't even use the word Holocaust. They should say I don't deny that something happened to the Jews, and they can say if they want, you know, it wasn't very nice or something, and things like that. But I don't think they should use the word Holocaust, and certainly not the Holocaust. It doesn't make any sense. But these people are just trying to defend themselves. Plus, they want to get along with everyone. Anyway, to go on, talking about who the revisionists are. Anyway, in Wikipedia, I think this is probably on the Holocaust denial page, but they say Holocaust denial is a propaganda movement active in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe that seeks to deny the reality of the Nazi regime's systematic mass murder of 6 million Jews in Europe during World War II. Maybe Deborah Lipstadt wrote that that definition. But it says United States, Canada, and Western Europe. It says right there that that's where this movement is. Denying the Holocaust is a sign of anti-Semitism and, in some cases, fascist extremism. Well, I left that in just because that's the way they always picture it, too. They have to bring in that if you are a revisionist or a denier, then you're anti-Semitic. And that's why people don't want to be called that, because they still are offended or afraid or just don't want to be called an anti-Semite. And they don't want to be called a fascist, blah, blah. So this actually comes from a paper. This is from Wikipedia. This comes from a paper by that horrible Marcuse website. One of his students or something wrote this in one of her research papers. Even though the revisionists do come from the United States, Canada, and Western Europe, and not that much from Canada, these countries are not revisionist countries. These are the countries that supposedly have the most guilt or something in the, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't even say that. These are the countries that revisionists come from and operate in, but these governments of these countries don't promote revisionism at all any more than the governments in the East do. But the individuals in these countries care. There's a lot of individuals who care about it and risk their reputations and sacrifice things in order to try to get truth out. And this is what, and it's only seems to be people in, it only seems to be Western Europeans and those who also live in, you know, in the United States and Canada and so on. So, we're always told that Poles, Czechs, Russians, and Southern Slavs hate Jews or dislike Jews or resent Jews or they don't want Jews. They don't like the Jews, but they don't deny the Holocaust. So we have to look for the reason there. Of course, the reason is political ideology that comes into play here, not really religion, even though religion is a big barometer for people. I think more important than race when it comes down to it, but it doesn't play such a big part here, but political ideology does. Now, speaking of historical revisionism, I think this is taken from Wikipedia. I thought it was a pretty good section here. It's conducted to influence a target's ideology or politics. That's what it tells us, for a particular purpose. Often, that purpose is to achieve a nation's aims by transferring war guilt, demonizing an enemy, providing an illusion of victory, or preserving friendship. And so I say the same applies to accepted history. It's, you know, they're trying to act here on this page at Wiki that historical revisionism is something suspect, but regular history, as it's given and passed down to us, is perfectly fine. But to say that it's been created to be used to transfer war guilt, demonize an enemy, provide an illusion of victory, etc., etc., that's the same reason that they decide on their official history. For these reasons. And James M. McPherson, president of the American Historical Association in 2003, some people would want revisionist history understood as, quote, a consciously falsified or distorted interpretation of the past to serve partisan or ideological purposes in the present, unquote. Broadly understood, there are two motivations behind revisionist history: the ability to control ideological influence and to control political influence. Well, I put those two together, basically. You can make them two parts of the same thing, but political influence is based on ideological influence, really, and right? And the whole thing, you know, I should say here that in my mind, the most important thing of all to have things your way is political power. There's nothing greater than political power. But political power can have many things behind it. Not many things, but it can have money behind it. It can have the people with money behind it. So, but the aim that they have is political power. Because political power allows you to control and do everything that you want. And then you can attach your own ideology. You can carry on your own ideological beliefs when you have that political power. Well, that's the name of the game. That's the goal, I think. But I ask here, why don't Eastern Europeans care about a true history of Western Europe? I'm not sure they care about a true history of Eastern Europe. I'm not sure what they care about. I'll just go on. my answer to this is that they don't see Western Europe as the same as themselves. The Western Europeans, and especially the more Nordic one, the more Nordic one gets, have that altruistic desire to be fair. That's one thing that works in our in the favor of revisionism in this case, because our desire to be fair and our altruistic feelings of helping, empathy, you know, honesty, truth, make a lot of individuals in countries other than Germany in Europe feel like they want to support these Germans in their effort to get the truth out, because they recognize that it is about the Holocaust in particular, and World War II, their role, the German role in World War II also. And so these fair-minded Western Europeans do a lot in order to, they sacrifice a lot in order to do this. But you don't find that coming from as much from the southern Mediterranean countries, and you don't find it coming really at all from the Eastern European countries. There are a lot of Eastern Europeans who are racial thinkers and who embrace Holocaust revisionism as individuals on their own, like just talking about it on the internet generally, but they use they almost all have pseudonym names. They have screen names. They don't give their real names, and you don't really know much about them. Plus, none of them have taken it up as a real profession or study or hobby or anything like that. They've not gone beyond pretty much just chiming in with the rest, with the others, and saying, that I agree, things like that. So that's the distinction, I think, that you want to make as who's really working at it and putting a lot into it. If Western Europeans, especially Germans, are getting a raw deal and are being blamed for harming these Slavs and other Easterners, that is okay with the Slavs and Easterners, is what I mean here. They feel no brotherly sympathy when it comes to that. And in many cases, they enjoy their victimhood and the gifts and benefits it brings. So this is something that is a dividing line, in a way, between Eastern and Western Europe, even though along the racial line, those who want to promote race, the race unites, they say, oh, we're all one, we're all brothers, we're all in the same, we're all in the same boat. But there's not a lot of racialists who would admit to being racialists in Eastern Europe either. I'm not sure. Well, I'll just have to go on here. I can't answer every question. Now, on the list of, I was looking for Eastern European Holocaust revisionists. And on the list of columnists at Inconvenient History Journal, because I was reading something there, and I thought, oh, I'll look at these names. They have quite a long list of what they call their columnists, anybody who's ever had an article published there. I didn't see a single Slavic or Baltic or Balkan name. There are way too many British names on their list, that's for sure, in my opinion. But that's because that's the bent that they have there. And they're kind of liberal at Inconvenient History Journal. Not everybody who writes there, they have some of the stuff they publish is really good, I think. And then a lot of it I don't think too much of, because it's not challenging. It's just challenging the general lack of free speech about it. That's what a lot of it does, and that's where you get a lot of these British are willing to do that. But I went to www.revisionist.com, and they have a pretty good list of most of the revisionists who have done important work. And out of 70 or so that are named there, 21 are German-Austrian. That's the largest group. And these are the ones who have the strictest laws against it. But 21 are German-Austrian. 4 are British. 6 are French. 2 Italian. 2 Spanish. 18 Americans. 2 Canadians. And 1 Polish name. And that adds up to 55 Western Europeans to 1 Eastern European, the ratio there. And then there's some names. There's a few Arabic-type names or Middle Eastern names. There's a few odd things here and there. I couldn't tell what they were, but they didn't seem to be Western European, and that's what I was trying to get at. But so 55 out of 70. So it's mostly a Western European thing. And a lot of the Americans would be of old British extraction and German extraction too, and various things. But still, they were Americans, and the Americans come in second still to the German Austrians. And there's only a couple Austrians. Most of them are Germans. So I thought that was pretty telling, and I don't know how to do a better survey than that. Now, this one Polish man who was on there, his name is Dariusz Ratajczak, and Dariusz Ratajczak, and seems like a real good man. He died in 2010, though. He was a Polish historian. He did suffer for this. He was dismissed from his university teaching post. He was publicly vilified and convicted of Holocaust denial for having published arguments and evidence that cast doubt on aspects of the familiar Holocaust story. He held a doctoral degree in history and was the author of several books. So he was from Opel, and he was at the University of Opel. He was a lecturer at the History Institute of the University of Opel, and he was popular with students. In 1999, he was suspended after state prosecutors opened an investigation into the publication of his book. He had written a book. It was called Dangerous Themes in English. And in a 5-page section of this short book, it was a little book, and it was only 5 pages, in which he headed Holocaust revisionism. And he cited, matter-of-factly, the work of nonconformist researchers such as Paul Rassinier, Robert Faurisson, David Irving, and Ernst Zundel, who had contended that there was no German plan or program to exterminate Europe's Jews. He cited forensic investigations carried out into Auschwitz and Birkenau camps, and by Fred Luchter and Germar Rudolph, and their conclusions, that Zyklon B could not have been safely used to kill these large numbers of Jews, and all of this stuff. Well, what he was doing was giving, according to him, he was giving the Holocaust revisionist side in a matter-of-fact way. He wasn't saying that he believed it or that he was promoting it, but he's saying this is what, because he was talking about dangerous themes in this book, and this is definitely a dangerous theme, and he probably sympathized with it. I'm sure he did sympathize, but he was trying to be a scout, just, historical about it, and he didn't explicitly endorse these views. But he did call eyewitness testimony useless, and he described establishment Holocaust writers as followers of a religion of the Holocaust who impose on others a false image of the past. So that pretty much tells you where his sympathies were. He suggested that the number of Jews who died in the Holocaust was 3 million, not 6 million. Well, there you go with that, those high numbers. But anyway, he published 320 copies of the book in March 1999 at his own expense. He obviously cared about this. And only a few were sold at the university. But he thought that what he was doing was okay, and he could get away with it. Because he only published a few books, and a few were sold in the university bookstore, but mostly were just given away to friends, to his students, and so on. But it set off a storm of fierce criticism, and his critics charged that his book represented the first serious case of Holocaust denial in Poland. They also noted that he had published articles in some patriotic nationalist periodicals with Polish names. And Ratajczak was charged with having violated a Polish law that makes it illegal to publicly deny crimes against humanity. Well, I mean, look, we're seeing that you get into big trouble when you do this. I mean, it's no wonder people avoid it. But the thing is, when people really believe it, they want to get it out there to other people, and they take a lot of chances. If you don't really believe it, you're not going to do that. Or if you don't care enough, you're not going to do that. So this man said that he had put these things in this book in his court case, in his court hearing, not to endorse them, but just to illustrate their point of view, like giving all points of view. And he said that he had just summarized the opinions of historians and that his own views are not in line with those opinions, he said in court. He says, I was only presenting various views on the Holocaust to students, the pro view and the against view and so on. And no time did he ever dispute or deny that Jews had been killed in gas chambers. So in September 1999, he then arranged for a second edition of 30,000 copies of his book, which was published by a small firm in Warsaw, and a few thousands were reportedly sold through kiosks and newsstands and by mail order across Poland. There's a market of some size. And in December of that year, a court in Opel found him guilty of violating Poland's Holocaust denial law. But the court found that the book's limited distribution was not damaging enough to warrant punishment, and that only 320 copies of this self-published book had been issued. So it said that he had caused only negligible harm to society. And that in the second edition, he had indeed criticized some denial arguments. So, he pulled back, but he still wanted to get this stuff out there. But critics regarded the court's verdict as too lenient, insisting that he deserved imprisonment. This prosecutors thought so also. But I think that he was not imprisoned, and he might not even have been fined, but at the university where he taught, students, even though students signed petitions supporting him, and he rejected all the charges against him, and he appealed for an outright acquittal in the court. And so then the university dismissed him from his teaching post. I guess the courts didn't actually convict him, but the university dismissed him and banned him for 3 years from teaching in Polish universities. And so maybe the court did that. I don't know. They dropped the other proceedings against him on the condition that he refrain from similar offenses for 1 year. In 2005, he published another edition of this book, merely attributed to revisionist researchers' skeptical claims. Anyway, he never returned to teaching, and for the remaining 10 years of his life, he was forced to work at menial employment, it says. And then later, in 2010, he was found in a car parked near a shopping center in Opal. He had been dead for nearly 2 weeks. The cause of death was uncertain. He was only 47 years old. He was survived by a son and a daughter, but he might have committed suicide. Or somebody might have killed him, but it's more likely, to my way of thinking, that he was so undone by the whole thing, he committed suicide. So here's a man who stands out. And here's some things that he said in an interview he gave in 2002. Ratajak is his name. Although the cretinous Marxists are already gone, they have been adequately replaced with empty-headed, politically correct idiots who are as numerous in Poland as in Australia. Stupidity is not picky about continents, it seems. It is they, those good-for-nothing historians, who finish off history, which in their version ceases to be the carrier of truth, the mistress of life, the reason for national pride. It is they who deliberately convert history into a handmaid of current political interests of equally morally and intellectually cheap ruling elites. Finally, it is they who decide which fact or historical figure to make prominent and about which to keep silent to the death. Of course, they do it from the angle of current political usefulness. As I said, that's what it's all about. Another quote from him, a historian has one basic role to perform. It is to reach the truth. In essence, truth is a historian's only friend. A historian ought to know that truth has no hues. Truth is always clear and one. That's very good. Striving after truth, a historian should avoid, like fire, friendly whispers such as, any coin has two sides, the golden mean, make a compromise, etc., because they lead him astray, get him closer to lying. After ascertaining the truth, and here we are touching a historian's other role, the investigator should share the truth with others, regardless of the consequences. Well, that's what he felt he should try to do. But he was the only one that I know of on that side of what used to be the Iron Curtain that has done that. After all, he said, truth must have not only an individual dimension, but also a social one. Well, he wrote some great stuff. I wonder if that little book of his is available, but probably, you know, it doesn't say anything that I wouldn't expect it to say. Here's another one, though. The sine qua non condition for practicing history, that is, freedom of speech, is already a past memory. It has been replaced with political correctness, that is, social liberal censorship, or as somebody has nicely put it, a tyranny of good intentions. Thus, in today's grim time, the sine qua non condition for practicing history is the historian himself, truthful, independent, immune to punches, and finally, simply courageous. Yes, we have lived to see times when, jokingly speaking, but it is a bitter joke, a historian should be a cross between an intellectual and a boxer. The last one, at present, the charge of anti-Semitism has become a sort of exceptionally brutal weapon, which the establishment uses ruthlessly against independent thinking men, for the greater fun of it, also against Jews such as Dr. Israel Shahak. Okay, well, something that just happened to come into my inbox this week when I was thinking about this topic was a short article by Paul Grubach, who's a well-known Holocaust revisionist who sort of, as far as I'm concerned, kind of dropped out of sight for quite a while. He used to write a lot of these really long articles, and some of them went into the Inconvenient History Journal and, I don't know, other places. But now he's into writing some shorter pieces that are tied in with current events. And this one is Russia and the Holocaust Ideology. What is the future of Holocaust revisionism in Eastern Europe? So I thought, well, great, you know. And I read this, and it was slightly disappointing to me because it didn't say anything new. It just talked about, you know, what's going on with Putin and his laws to to ban Holocaust denial or any kind of revision of World War II history in Russia, making it a 5-year prison sentence. But I'm going to read now what Paul wrote because it's informative and it's not too long, and it's new. He writes, in 2009, then reigning Russian President Dmitry Medvedev and Israeli President Shimon Peres issued a joint statement clearly demonstrating how important the Holocaust doctrine is to Russia's national patriotic ideology and, in turn, to its foreign policy in Eastern Europe and the surrounding regions. They stated, these two, Medvedev and Shimon Peres, we express our deep indignation at attempts to deny the great contribution that the Russian people and other peoples of the Soviet Union brought to the victory over Nazi Germany, and also attempts to deny the Holocaust of European Jews. So here they're defending the Red Army, the Red Army's liberation of the people of, that comes later. They're defending the contribution of the Russian people in the Soviet Union in their victory over Germany. It is important to note that this statement was issued on the heels of Eastern European movements that honored those that fought alongside the Germans in World War II. Clearly, the Kremlin sees the threat that Holocaust revisionism poses to the political ideology that they promote and depend upon. Although Russia supplies and backs Israel's enemies, on the issue of Holocaust mythology, there is convergence of interests between international Jewish Zionism and Israel on the one hand and the Russian government on the other hand. With this in mind, it should come as no surprise that in early May 2014, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a law that renders denial of Nazi crimes and distortion of the Soviet Union's role in World War II criminal offenses, which are punishable by up to 5 years in prison. The Kremlin leaders are astute enough to realize that the Holocaust doctrine is indeed Russia's baby. The Holocaust and the Russian patriotic view of World War II are intimately linked. If you disprove and trash the Holocaust, ultimately, the whole Russian patriotic view of World War II will be dragged into the garbage can along with the Holocaust. The Kremlin's reasoning goes something like this. Well, yes, Stalin did oppress and commit crimes against Russian and Eastern European peoples, but the Nazis were far worse as they mass murdered 6 million Jews and millions of non-Jews. So yes, even though Stalin committed his crimes, in the end, Stalinist Russia was a benefit to humanity because it saved the world from the far greater menace of murderous Nazism, unquote. Well, that's the way they have it. That's right. So Paul goes on, one can now plainly see why Putin would outlaw Holocaust revisionism. It is a direct threat to the ideology that justifies and legitimizes his government and political agenda. Indeed, a revisionist repudiation of the Holocaust ideology would allow another reappraisal of the crimes, atrocities, genocide, and oppression committed by the Stalinist regime. The end result of such historical revisionism would be the demolition of a pillar of Russian patriotic ideology and the worldwide realization that Stalinist communism was more oppressive and evil than National Socialism. And this view is promoted in many countries in Eastern Europe, that many Slavic countries, I haven't used the word Slavic, Slav, but they're not all Slavic, but amongst the Slavic countries, they feel they have a love-hate relationship maybe with Russia. You know, they want to be proud of Russia as one of their Slavic, great Slavic nations, but at the same time, they've suffered from that country. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, and I can't say that I have real understanding of the Slavic mind or the way they think. I know they like to say, we're just like you. We're no different. Or, you know, we're all white. But I think they are different in a lot of ways. They've had a different history, a different certainly different experiences in modern history. So, I can't put myself in their shoes, but anyway, I'll go on with Paul here. Furthermore, the Putin government needs to use the Holocaust as an ideological weapon against those non-Russian ethnic groups, such as the Ukrainians that backed the Germans during World War II and are presently in conflict with Russia. We saw this in the recent conflict in the Ukraine. Russia's Ukrainian opponents were depicted by Russian officials as rampaging neo-Nazis who wanted to create a new Auschwitz, unquote. Even the bitter intellectual opponent of Holocaust revisionism, Deborah Lipstadt, admits that Stalin killed more people than Hitler. If you disprove and discredit the Holocaust in the eyes of the world, then Stalinist Russia arguably takes the place of Nazism as the most sinister and brutal tyranny the world has ever seen. And this would be a severe blow to Russia's national image and its foreign policy in Eastern Europe and the surrounding regions. In a word, Holocaust revisionism could end up demolishing the very ideology that the Putin government promotes and depends upon. And I emphasize, as he is not, he seems to believe, it's the Putin government. The Putin government promotes this and depends upon it. It's for this reason I believe that Putin outlawed it. Well, that's easy to come to. More generally, I don't know if I should, do I need to read all the rest of this? He says in here that although it can be disproved by reason and science, the Holocaust doctrine continues to service the political, economic, social, and psychological needs of very powerful Jewish and non-Jewish power elites worldwide. For this reason, Holocaust nonsense may have a very bright future. That's true. But lo and behold, Russia's outlawing of Holocaust denial may have a different effect upon those Eastern European peoples that are currently in conflict with Russia and who backed the Germans during World War II. Well, he's got to be referring to, at least partly, referring to the Ukrainians. Russia's criminalization of Holocaust revisionism could spark in these anti-Russian ethnic groups a renewed interest in debunking the Holocaust, as the later may correctly see that the Holocaust ideology is simply an ideological weapon of one of their enemies, the Russian government. So why shouldn't these anti-Russian ethnic groups debunk an ideology that is used against their people and country? Well, they've got their own reasons. They've got their own reasons for keeping it alive. Even the Ukrainians, don't want, they feel like they all want to play the victim of the Nazis. That's what they like doing that. They get something from it. Anyway, Paul seems to, you know, hold out this little bitty tiny hope. I don't put much into that. But he says, in conclusion, well, so certainly just, you know, nobody can predict the future, blah, blah. Well, I predict it's not going to fare well at all, that Holocaust revisionism. He says, only time will tell how Holocaust revisionism will fare in Eastern Europe and Russia's neck of the woods. And my comment, I certainly predict it's not going to fare well at all. But I'm going to move on now. I found a couple of things I thought were interesting that about Vladimir Putin and his real beliefs. People are trying to make him out to be some kind of a freedom fighter, trying to fight against NATO and the decadent West and so on, whereas he seems to be a devoted Soviet communist, he's a devoted Russian, you might say, who doesn't want to see the Soviet Union era as a deviation from regular Russian history. So there is something at a site called RussianFront.com, and I'm calling it Putin's reading list because it was talking about Putin was asked about what he's been reading, and this is pretty recent, and he gave some answers in this kind of in an interview. And so here it says, the names Putin gives us are standard figures in the Soviet pantheon of literature who wrote books on the war that were perfectly politically correct. These are the names he gives. Konstantin Simonov, Mikhail Sholokhov, Boris Voromyev, and in particular Vladimir Bogomolov. Bogomolov was a veteran of Soviet military counterintelligence, though there's some controversy over his military service. And the book that Putin recommends by this man is Moment of Truth, also known as In August 1944. Those would be the English titles, which glorifies the work of Smersh, S-M-E-R-S-H, in parentheses, death to spies, in restoring Soviet rule in liberated territory. Smersh was something based on the translated special methods of spy detection, was an umbrella name for three independent counterintelligence agencies in the Red Army, formed in late 1942 or even earlier, but officially founded on 14 April 1943. The name Smersh was coined by Joseph Stalin. The main reason for its creation was to subvert the attempts by German forces to infiltrate the Red Army. So it was a counterintelligence thing, it was certainly Joseph Stalin was involved in it. He coined the term, supposedly. And anyway, this goes on to say that two names leap out by their absence, who Putin did not mention, and that is Viktor Nekrasov and Vasily Grossman. I've done no survey, but my sense is that if you ask people who really know literature about the best work to come out of the Great Fatherland War, Nekrasov and Grossman would be the first mentioned. So why doesn't Putin mention them? I can't speak for him, but Nekrasov ended up expelled from the Soviet Union and stripped of his citizenship, while Grossman couldn't get his masterwork Life and Fate published because of the uncomfortable parallels he drew between Nazism and Stalinism. It certainly seems as though Vladimir Putin isn't comfortable with writers who aren't comfortable with the Soviet system. I thought that was pretty interesting, and it's probably true, seems to be true. A little more on Putin here. that I'll add from another site that is it's kind of a pro-U.S. site, but anyway, I'm going to read some things from it. Putin and friends continue to howl gigantic curses at anything that smacks of dissent from the Kremlin-mandated version of events. It's hard not to notice an obsession with World War II emanating from Russia in this and Moscow-approved outlets. Now, these Moscow-approved outlets would be information outlets, I take it, including those who just got a whole raft of medals from the Kremlin for their objective coverage of Russia's recent annexation of Crimea. And they love, these outlets love to mention that war in Ukraine all the time. Not a day goes by without Russian media complaining about Ukrainians daring to dissent from the narrative that Stalin's armies liberated Western Ukraine in 1944. And this is the kind of what to somebody like me and probably a lot of you, it's humorous. It's funny. It's like, I don't believe it, that they think people are going to believe that, continue to believe that Stalin, that the Red Army liberated the Eastern European countries, or what here they're calling Western Ukraine, but all those nations, they should be grateful that Russia really still expects them to be grateful for what the Soviets did. Many have noticed that the orange-black ribbon worn prominently by pro-Moscow fighters in Ukraine today is that of the Order of St. George, a top Tsarist medal for bravery that was resurrected by Putin in 2000. But not coincidentally, it's also the ribbon of the medal commemorating Soviet victory over Germany in the Great Patriotic War, which was issued to tens of millions of Soviet citizens. You can't hardly go anywhere in Russia without encountering an elderly veteran wearing one. This medal is easy to spot because it's got Stalin's image on it. And he says such things matter in collective memory. So, you know, in the collective memory, when they see that they're giving out these orange black ribboned medals to the people who are writing about Ukraine in the way that they like them to be doing, saying the things they want, and this medal back from the Soviet Great Patriotic War days had the same orange-black ribbon. So it has a psychological effect, and even more than psychological. This is how they do things. You know, I have come to realize since this Ukraine thing started that Putin's Russia is just as big on using intelligence and spies and so on, and just as big on controlling the information that the people in Russia get and what they think and so on as it ever was in the past. Russia is Russia, it seems. And while everybody does that and tries to do it, they are extremely on top of that kind of thing. And they depend on it, and they do. They may be the real masters of it. I don't think there's a whole lot different there than it was during the Soviet Union. Now that, you know, the more I look into it. But a recent piece written by retired General Mahmut Gareyev makes clear Putin's ideology, this writer says. This Mahmut Gareyev is a prolific writer on issues of defense and strategy who happens to head Russia's Academy of Military Sciences. Despite Gareyev's advanced age, he's past 90, and he's also a Muslim Tatar. He churns out a lot of turgid writings on military matters, and can be considered an official mouthpiece of the Kremlin. His recent analysis deals with the problems of Western soft power and advises what Russia should do about it. So, yeah, this seems to be true that in Russia today, the line is that the West is using soft power instead of hard power, or not military power, but trying to import our decadent culture into Russia. And that's the way we want to take over Russia. Actually, we say that it's the Jews who bring it into all of our countries, but they don't blame the Jews for it. They are blaming the Western nations, and the United States probably especially, for this. Knowing that Jews run the United States, but they don't talk about that. So, let's see, the last part I've got here. Oh, is that, okay, thanks to regime policies, most Russians are wholly ignorant of the truths of the world's greatest conflict, meaning World War II. Most Russians, and this is true, are ignorant of what's true about it. They have heard what they're taught there in their own country, and they believe it, and they don't really know. They don't have access, or they're not encouraged to, and so they don't. A lot of them aren't very simple people, and they don't find out what the other side of the story is. And now it's really criminalized if they do. So they're saying here that the truth about this conflict, and this again now is here, you're going to really hear it from the United States point of view here, but namely that Stalin partnered with Hitler to start the conflagration in which the USSR was just as complicit as Germany. Together, that's the truth. Together, the Nazis and Soviets raped and pillaged Poland, while Stalin stole not just half of Poland, but all the Baltics, plus parts of Romania and Finland. Well, that is true. Approved Russian histories mention none of this. And instead, the Great Patriotic War begins suddenly and mysteriously on 22nd June 1941 with the German invasion. Of course, the USSR was in no sense a victim of World War II. Rather, it was one of the two countries that caused it. Inconveniently for Stalin, his partner in crime turned on him almost 2 years after their dirty deal to divide Eastern Europe between them. Well, to say that the USSR was not a victim of World War II, but one of the two countries that caused it, huh? Well, it certainly wasn't two countries that caused it. The United States, Britain, France were part of causing it at the very least, but that's not mentioned here. So everything is biased in one direction or another. So it says, average Russians are emotionally invested in the potent lies of the official narrative, and it's hard to blame them since most of them have never heard any other version of events. But it's important to note that lies about 1939 to 1945 continue to serve as a justification for Russian crimes in Ukraine right now, and it's unwise to expect Moscow to be honest about the present when the Kremlin continues to be deeply dishonest about events in its now receding past. All right, that's all I'm going to say about the Europeans and the Eastern and Western Europeans. I'm now going to go on to an article that I found in Smith's report this week, and the new Smith's report, Bradley Smith, that little newsletter that Bradley Smith puts out. But I think before I get into that, I'm going to go ahead and play a little short version here of Lily Marlene just to take a little break. Some of you listening might want one, and I could use one. I'm going to play this special version of Lily Marlene, the one that's very different And it is 3 minutes and 5 seconds long. So I'll be back when this is over. Carolyn Yeager at the Heretics Hour on June 16th. We're the halfway through the tonight's program, and I'm moving on to something related, but a little bit different. It's more about revisionism because it's from Bradley Smith's newsletter. But it's an article, they're all short, but a short article from there that I was shocked at what it said. And I was shocked at Bradley's response to it, too. I have to say, I know Bradley is a very tolerant person, and I know that he's more focused probably on the Palestinians and their problems, as some others are, than really his interest in the Germans anymore. He tries to be balanced about it, but he brings in a lot of Jewish so-called historical revisionists or something who are against the way Israel treats the Palestinians and thinks this makes them into good people. And so this crazy article is titled "Palestinian Professor's Trip to Auschwitz Sparks Needed Debate" by Ray Hanania. And it says when Mohammed Dajani Dowj, a Palestinian professor at Al-Quds University in occupied Jerusalem, organized a trip for his students to visit several former Nazi concentration camps. He sparked an important debate. Well, this important debate could have been an important debate, but it's not. And this Ray says, unfortunately, the debate has been one-sided, focusing on Arab denial of the Holocaust while ignoring Israel's denial of its oppression of Palestinian rights. The author says the Holocaust did happen. More than 6 million Jews were murdered in gas chambers, and their remains were incinerated in ovens. When I first read that, I thought, well, maybe he's being ironic. Maybe this is, you know, I have to go on and read this to see. I don't think he could really mean that. He must have some point that he's making here. But no, it turns out that this is exactly what he believes. And he says, so why do some Arabs deny the Holocaust? Most are angry because they believe the political movement of the Jewish people, Zionism, exploited the Holocaust to browbeat Western audiences into sympathizing with them over the Palestinian cause. Well, that's true. And so Jews won the political battle there. Jews were the smarter ones, and they won the political battle over being able to use the Holocaust for their own purposes. And this makes the Arabs angry now that once they realize it. And the debate that this man is talking about turns out to be the debate between whether Arabs actually deny the Holocaust or are just angry for political reasons at how the Holocaust has been used against them, has been used to browbeat Europe into supporting the Jews and not supporting the Arabs. I hope I made myself clear there. So he goes on to say, many Arabs and Muslims don't believe the Holocaust happened. They think it's a big lie. But for most, now that was many of them just really don't believe it. But for most, the denial of the Holocaust is more about anger than rejection of a historical fact. When you get beyond the anger Arabs and Muslims have against the hypocrisy of the West, and they're angry at the West, and Israel's war crimes against Palestinians, most Arabs know the Holocaust did happen. What they don't get is that the Nazis hated the Arabs as much as they hated Jews, but never got around to exterminating them because Adolf Hitler's Third Reich never lasted the 1,000 years he intended. If it had lasted that long, Adolf Hitler would have exterminated the Arabs too. That's what this man believes, not just the Jews. He would have gone ahead and exterminated all the Jews and then turned on the Arabs. And maybe after that, somebody else and somebody else. He says, it is a certainty that Hitler's racial superiority would have eventually targeted the Arabs and Muslims, as it did more than 12 million other non-Jews, Slavs, and Russians during the war. That human beings abandon their humanity when it comes to their enemies is a sickness that results from conflict. Many Arabs have rejected the Holocaust and Jewish suffering because of the intensity of the endless Middle East conflict. Arabs wonder how a people who suffered so much could so easily turn around and brutalize another people. They're speaking about the Jews. Israel is not gassing Palestinians. Israel is not incinerating their bodies. Israel is, however, engaging in the oppression of a people purely because of their religion. Palestinians are Christian and Muslim, not Jewish. Israel is trying to force them out of the Holy Land so it can create a Jewish state. Many Israelis, now they call that a religion. Jewish state would be a religious Jewish state. Many Israelis do not want non-Jews, especially Arabs, to live in Israel. They want to force them to leave. So they have massacred thousands of Palestinians. They have jailed tens of thousands of civilian Palestinians in the Israeli prison Gulag. They have denied basic human and civil rights to Christian and Muslim Arabs. They have taken Christian and Muslim lands. They have expelled Christians and Muslims from Israel and from the Israeli-occupied West Bank. He's trying to connect Christians and Muslims together. They have built a wall around the Palestinians and placed gun turrets and armed military checkpoints throughout. The Israeli-occupied West Bank is an open-air prison of brutality, but it is not the same as the Holocaust. What Israel is doing to Palestinians cannot be compared to what the Nazis did at Auschwitz-Birkenau or Krakow. Now listen to this guy. You know, as bad as the Jews are treating them, his Palestinians, who he cares about, he still says they're not nearly as bad as those Nazis were and what the Nazis did to them. Yet that does, reading him again now, he says, yet that does not justify Jews closing their eyes to what their own people are doing to the Palestinians. It doesn't justify Jewish denial of Palestinian rights. Denial exists on both sides. It is a sickness that comes from a conflict that feeds extremism and grows hatred. We have to stop it on both sides. Professor Dajani was right to teach his students about the Holocaust, period. When Arabs understand the Holocaust, they can better understand how to correctly portray Israel's atrocities against Christians and Muslims inside Israel and in the occupied territories. But the debate Dajani sparked has been truncated. The discussion should be expanded. It's true that during World War II, some Palestinians invoked the biblical proverb, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and some allied themselves with the Nazis. But no one knew the extent of the atrocities being committed in the concentration camps. Thousands of Arabs fought during World War II wearing American and British uniforms to defeat the Nazis. My father and uncle were among the American soldiers who fought to liberate Auschwitz and other Nazi death camps. Professor Dajani's trip to Auschwitz was only one part of the story. While Professor Dajani's students learned about the Holocaust, an Israeli professor took his Jewish students to learn about the Nakba. The Nakba is the Arab term symbolizing the Israeli defeat of the Palestinians and the occupation of Palestine land during the 1948 war. Well, you can't compare that war with World War II, but in any event, it was a bad thing. The Nakba also refers to Israeli brutality against Christian and Muslim Palestinians inside Palestine. That suffering is denied by many Israelis and Jews, and it is just as immoral as denying the Holocaust. So it's immoral to deny the Holocaust, he is saying in this Smith's Report article. So intense is the hatred of Palestinians by Israelis that Israel has adopted laws to prohibit Palestinians from showcasing Israel's atrocities. It is a crime in Israel to talk about, promote, or commemorate the Nakba. Israelis can deny what they do to Palestinians, but Palestinians cannot deny what the Nazis did to Jews. The two issues are unrelated, but are both crimes. I hope the debate over Dajani expands to include Israel's hypocrisy. Maybe it will help Arabs to become more strategic in addressing Israel's atrocities and violations of Palestinian civil rights. We don't need Holocaust denial to fight Israel. In fact, embracing the Holocaust and recognizing it for the inhumanity that it was is the first step in exposing the extremism that continues to grow in Israel. I am totally flummoxed by this article. You know, it's stupid in, for one thing. And it talks about a needed debate by this Professor Dajani, who took his students to Auschwitz. I guess it was Auschwitz. Yeah. And then there's a little debate there about why some Arabs deny the Holocaust, and he's saying they shouldn't. He's insisting that it all happened and so on. And this Ray Hanaria is managing editor of the Arab Daily News at thearabdailynews.com online. And then Bradley writes, after this, his comment, which just put me in a mood. Bradley writes, I like this article, though in the end, Hanania caves before the challenge of questioning the gas chamber stories. The stories that are used consistently to morally legitimate the issues he addresses here. What's that mean? You know, what is going on with Bradley? I'm wondering if Bradley is he's pretty old, and maybe it's time for him to retire. I don't say that in a mean way. I really like Bradley. I know Bradley, and he's always been very, very nice to me. He's the most forgiving and easygoing guy, and probably just way too much. But I don't know how he can like the article and how he can say that in the end, I mean, he did it right in the beginning, but in the end, he says Hanania caves before the challenge of questioning the gas chamber. Well, he didn't even start to. There was no challenge to him. He never even, all he said from the beginning was that the Holocaust was real, but some Arabs deny it, but most of the Arabs who say they don't believe in it, it's just because they're angry. They really do believe it, but they're angry because of the way it's been used to make the Europeans help the Jews and not help them. So it's everybody out for himself, you know, everybody looking for his own interests. And what I take from all of this, that I have said in the first hour and this article here, that the only people standing up for truth for Europeans is Western Europeans. That's it. Because all the rest fall aside, have other interests, have other purposes, and they don't give a damn about what's in the interest of Western Europeans. And I think that no matter whether they're white or brown or black or purple, there are those who don't have love for Western Europeans. And I relate to Western Europeans. And I relate to, naturally, to Germany, who is at the heart of this Holocaust and World War II big lie campaign. And I appreciate all those Europeans who are Western Europeans, although I did mention this one Polish man. And I tried to, you know, say a lot about him. But I really appreciate all that they do and the way they are willing to sacrifice to stand up for truth. And we're really on our own in this. And this idea that, well, these people are going to help us and those people are going to help us do this. In the end, they're only looking for how to help themselves. And that's all right. I mean, I think that's perfectly all right. You shouldn't expect anything different, and then it shows that we are different. We're not the same. We have different cultures. Even Eastern Europeans have somewhat different culture than Western Europeans. So that's my point in this, and in answer to to Marcus's question, of course, I think he knew the answer already, but, you know, looking at it, where are the Eastern Europeans in the area of truth, historical truth? Generally, the truth that they're interested in is what affects them and their own histories, and not our history, not the Western Europe's history. They have a kind of a mixed feelings toward Western Europe. So All right, I'm going to move on now because I have quite a bit. I don't know how I'll get into it all, but I want to talk about David Cole. I'll at least get that done. Let's see. I have David Cole, and after that, I have something about the death of Himmler, and I don't have to do that, but I thought that was pretty interesting. And then, I was going to talk about Klaus Lund and National Socialism. Well, I'll probably jump to that after David Cole. Well, here again, Bradley. I'm not done with Bradley yet. Bradley Smith has always been friends with David Cole going way back, and now they are friends again, and he's been featuring him on his Founders Page blog and so on. And David Cole has picked up the friendship with Mark Weber also from back when. And I want to give you my thoughts about David Cole. In Chapter 1 of Republican Party Animal, speaking about his life as David Cole, the revisionist, he said, "I never denied the Holocaust, nor did I spread hate, except for the Nazis, whom I do indeed hate." Wow. When I saw him on those, I don't think I saw him when he was actually on those talk shows on television with Bradley and Mark Weber. I only saw him later on video. But I never picked up that he had any hatred for the Nazis. He never talked about it. And in that, in his video about his visit to Auschwitz, where he talked to the head historian and they learned about that they knew that the gas chambers weren't real and had been built later and so on, which was quite a revelation at the time. He didn't say anything like that then either. So I found this to be quite interesting, to say the least, that he's saying this now. And it's true he didn't. He didn't deny, and but he makes a big deal now that he didn't, and that he hates the Nazis, just like every Jew, has to do. Now he also wrote. He says in his book that while he was David Stein, he wrote hundreds of articles slamming radical Islam and warning of the consequences should it go unchecked. But he says he never expressed hatred against them except for, quote, the modern-day Islamic equivalent of the Nazis, unquote. Now, I didn't say, and I hope you all know, that David Cole became David Stein after he disappeared. And nobody knew that David Stein was David Cole, and he became this Republican Party activist and started this group, the Republican Party Animals, which was a bunch of partying stuff. And he says he's become a heavy drinker. He says he's practically an alcoholic, says he has a serious drinking problem, and a lot of things like that. I'll continue from where I am, though, just when I'm talking about his book before I go into anything else. Then he also insulted Ernst Zundel by saying he's nuts about Ernst, but he's not dangerous because, he says, Ernst believes Adolf Hitler was framed. He makes fun of that. He thinks Adolf Hitler was framed. Ernst loves Adolf Hitler, believes in him, so that means he's nuts. But he's not dangerous. So that's all I have from the book, because I haven't read all the book, but there might be some more very interesting things. But he talks in from Appendix A in the book is where he has all of his, where he has stated what he actually believes about the Holocaust. And this is what he says about the gas chambers. He says that there were no automated gas chambers. They were simple creations, rooms with the exhaust of a car or truck piped in. The gas chambers were simply rooms with no windows, a locked door, and car exhaust piped in. Big outdoor pits, not crematoriums, were used for burning bodies. Yet he thinks that all worked. He thinks that these gas chambers actually worked and killed, he says, 2.5 million people. He's using the same David Irving, Mark Weber stuff. I don't know if he believes a word of it. I don't know if he's studied up on it again himself, or if he used to believe this, or if he's just saying this now because, you know, he's had to come up with what he was going to say once he got outed and people knew he was David Cole. Then he had to decide, and I'm sure he did some pretty heavy-duty thinking and decision-making about how he was going to present himself, what was his next steps were going to be, and how he was going to deal with that and how he was going to keep his life going. So he seems to have decided to be to play both sides, you know, to sit on the fence or spread on both sides of the fence and say that he doesn't believe in the Holocaust as it is. Everything he said back then, it was he believed and he still believes. But he didn't say everything back then. And he's saying now that a lot of the Holocaust was true, just not all of it. And that's how he's dealing with it. He's being very faithful to Jews in being exceptionally anti-Hitler. That's who they, because they especially hate him. But he says that from 1942 through 1943, Polish Jewry was subjected to one of the most brutal campaigns of mass murder in human history. What he's talking about, the Reinhardt camps. That he's talking about sending these Jews to these camps, Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec, and which were actual death camps, and gassing them and burning their bodies there, which is absolutely it's not defensible what he's saying, but he's saying it anyway because David Irving says it, and Mark Weber says it, not that Mark Weber is so important. But, and so he's saying it. It really takes away all respect that you can have for this person. And the fact, then he says in the fact, he goes on. At these camps, there was so much secrecy surrounding these four extermination camps, Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec. And the fact that they were plowed under and erased from existence in 1943, it's difficult to be precise about certain details. Yeah, I guess. He doesn't have any, he can't, it's not proven, it can't be proven. If you look at the latest video, film, should say a film, from, long film from Eric Hunt on Treblinka, it's not the best thing he's ever done, but it does show what's going on with that whole story there. It's very good, but Eric has something something pretty good in the works. It's pretty sophisticated and difficult to do. He's got some people working with him, so I'm he clued me in on what it was, but I'm waiting for him to have something to say about that or to have something to show about it. And I'd like to have him on my interview him again when he gets that together. But Eric Hunt is probably doing some of the best work. Well, I know these, I know Matonio, Groff, and Cuse, I believe they are working on something, and they've got some real good stuff too that they're working on, but it's not, you know, you haven't heard anything about it, so it's not at a stage yet. So we just have to wait for the next steps to be coming. But this stuff from David Cole is really pretty ridiculous. He says that, he says, we do know that some Jews were sent to those camps as a throughway to other destinations. See, well, where do they know that from? Eric Hunt has done a great deal to prove this, but also the other three that I mentioned in that latest book that they came out with, which was the rebuttal to the foolish bloggers, to the four, five, or six bloggers. They went into all of that, a lot of this. So he has to say that. He realizes that it's been shown now, where it used to be that everybody that was sent there, that's it. They were all sent there, and they never left. But now he's saying that, well, some of them went there before they went somewhere else. But he says more than enough circumstantial evidence exists to show that for most Jews, the train ride to those camps was one way and final. Well, really, you know, what is this circumstantial evidence? He doesn't go into it. He goes over all these views, and now he says there was no plan to exterminate the Jews at the Von C conference, and there was never a master plan to kill the Jews. That's very much like Irving. Is he just taking it directly from Irving now? Is he reduced to that? We used to think he was such a bright guy for all the things he noticed and brought out. Now he's just following David Irving, who's obviously trying to cover himself by saying things that he might not even believe. But what he does say that would be interesting for other people is that in 1944, Auschwitz was a labor camp and not an extermination camp. Therefore, no Hungarian Jews were gassed there. And the whole Hungarian Jew story, you know, Spielberg's Hungarian Jew story that he's invested so much in, was that how many hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews were gassed at Auschwitz in 1944? That's in this this thing that couldn't have happened because they were gassing so many of them in a short period of time, and then they had to cremate them all, and then they had to bury the bones and so on and the ashes, and it was just totally impossible. But this is the story, but he's saying that story is not true, but the Reinhardt story is true, and it's based on the same old thing, the Corhair report that stated that 2.5 million Jews were transferred to these camps. It doesn't say that they were murdered, but they assume that they were transferred there to be murdered. And then the Corhair report jives with this message in a telegram by Hermann Hefele, who was in Lublin, and he sent this telegram to Haim in Krakow stating the same type of thing. But none of it none of it said, well, we're killing these Jews. It didn't say that. It just talked about Jews being transported around and transported there, supposedly. I don't think that's even exactly, it's not exactly clear. Cole claims that that he believes that Himmler stated in his speech to the generals at Sonthofen that they killed a large amount of Jews. Well, that he didn't say any number, and he didn't even say that exactly. The text of the speech is not specific, proves nothing. So this is what we're left with David Cole Stein. And, you know, what I just say about him, he's showing himself to be like a scam artist. And he admits it himself. He's a typical Jew. He's turned out to be. He says he was young and naive when he was associating with Zundel and Mark Weber and Bradley Smith, and they were probably paying his bills, and so he went along with them. Although he's the son of a wealthy man, and his mother, left this wealthy husband of hers while I don't know how old David was, but he was still living with her. So she may have gotten a good settlement from him. And so David always seems to have had plenty of money to live on. Not that he didn't work at this Republican Animal thing, but before that, as a revisionist, he wasn't working. But he must have had some income. But he looks, he's been doing these videos in a padded cell, you know, and I guess he's playing, he's kind of like doing it, trying to make these videos of his interesting and make, by playing a role of somebody locked in a padded cell, like, because he's a crazy revisionist who's now been outed and he's, but he looks like he's missing some teeth. His teeth are there, but looks, and he sounds, his voice sounds like he's missing some. I'm sure he must have some teeth, but he must take them out for this video. And he seems like he does this in such a way. He looks very disheveled in these videos. He's trying to play the role of a crazy person. And I think it's, well, it doesn't come across to me. I think it's too forced. And it turns me off, I'll tell you. I really, although I'm not always typical of everybody, but it's, in fact, I'm not typical of everybody, but it's, it really turns me off. It seems like he's written this book by trying to, in the interest of trying to turn what he considers his bad luck into something positive, which is money. And he seems like he likes being the center of attention, too. He's always found a way to be the center of attention, and he's trying to do it again. I don't think, though, that he's going to come out very well with this. There's something wrong about it, to my mind. And he says that his life as a party animal and his life as David Stein, he loved it. He loved it. He loved it much better than being a revisionist, but he says he's lost it now, and he's just trying to make the best of things. But he wishes he had it back, and he could still be doing that. And he's definitely seems to be sincerely a heavy drinker and somebody who needs excitement. I don't know what's going to happen to him. I had so much respect for that Auschwitz video he did, and so did so many other people. And so it's hard, you kind of don't want to turn against them, but I'm pretty much against them at this point. In fact, I'd say I am totally. Now, I came across Klaus Lund and an article he recently wrote that seems to be making the rounds and people are thinking it's so great. Klaus Lund is head of some kind of a Swedish National Socialist group called Nordfront. Well, their website is Nordfront. I've seen this so many times, but it's all in Swedish. And so, you know, it can't be read. I put a bunch of it in Google Translate, which works pretty well for the articles, but not very well for the comments, because comments are not written as well as articles are written, you know, in the language, so they don't translate as well into any other language. But I have to say, and Klaus Lund, I noticed a number of times he really strongly endorses and praises William Pierce. And it's kind of funny that a European National Socialist would get his ideas from William Pierce, who he says was a National Socialist. And supposedly William Pierce should have gotten his ideas from National Socialism, but these people want to change it. They want to change it, and that's the point of my last 15 minutes here, because what I said I would be talking about, should National Socialism be updated to bring it in line with the current times that we live in, to make it more, I guess, attractive to people so they don't say, oh, I don't want anything to do with that old National Socialism stuff. That's passé and that's all over with. Well, these people, I mean, it's good that these people appreciate what National Socialism is and appreciate what Adolf Hitler did. But I don't like the attitude that they're taking either. I'm pretty hard to please. And let's see, this was written just recently, and it's the description of it, National Socialism resistance leader Klaus Lund writes in his article that National Socialism has to adapt to the prevailing conditions without thereby losing its essence. So I just ask, what conditions? This appeals, it seems to me that this approach appeals to those who don't really fit into the National Socialist philosophy, or they don't fit into the racial aspect of National Socialism, and so they want what they want to still claim National Socialism, and they want to make it out to be something that can be different and that they can adapt to themselves however they want. And I disagree with that. I've disagreed with it all along, and I still do. So I thought I would just enter my objection here, and I'm going to read this article. I also feel that these people in Sweden, and they have a their organization includes Swedes, Norwegians, and Finns, and they've also associated with some Danes. So they're like this Scandinavian unity group, and that's good. But they want to be National Socialists, and they want to be Adolf Hitler National Socialists. But I think they might not really be the best people in National Socialism because they're not German. And I have never really understood Sweden and Swedish people. I haven't. I'm not attracted. They seem like they kind of repel. They're not very warm, they're different. They're not like. They're supposed to be Germanic, but they're not like Germans at all. None of those people are, although you could get along. I mean, Germans get along with them, and Hitler got along with them. Hitler hoped that they'd be part of his unified Germanic group, but Sweden was neutral in the war. It wouldn't support Germany. And, of course, we're talking about the government now, not these individuals in there, but this is the same as all the governments were. But there was a hotbed of spies and of every stripe and intrigue and so on, and people connecting with other people intelligence wise, and the Swedish government was helping the Soviet Union, actually. So I don't know, but I'm gonna read this. I think they don't quite have it, but Hitler was this. Klaus Lund seems to have a lot of respect from people. He's been heading this for a long time. He works hard. He writes a lot, so he's busy. And he says Hitler was, in my opinion, one of the last millennium's biggest personalities. But precisely because of it and the extreme conflict that was fought, posterity has difficulties in judging him properly. Too much emotion, propaganda, and political interest stand in the way. There we go again with the political. But it's not just the outside world that we have problems, that have problems with Hitler and the ideas that he stood for, but us too. He means, I guess, we Swedish National Socialists. And we Scandinavian National Socialists, we have some problems with him too. We recognizing him as one of the greatest reformers, should not indulge in any cultic or religious worship of him. Well, I would agree with that. Such an irrational element will not help the fight ahead. Hitler was a man like any other, with strengths and weaknesses, a man who appeared at a difficult time and who not only took good decisions, but also bad. Acknowledging this, one can admire and appreciate him as a great man even more, instead of indulging in the fantasy that he was some kind of a demigod. Well, there I think already I'm seeing a problem here. Where were the bad decisions that he made? People always want to say he made these bad decisions. But you have to ask if they're judged bad only because we have plenty of hindsight. After knowing how things turned out, you can say, well, that was a bad decision. But was it a bad decision at the time that he made it? Or was it, considering all that he knew and all the options and so on, was it, you know, was it maybe not a great decision, but it wasn't a bad decision? I don't know. I mean, I think that idea of calling things bad decisions from this standpoint now is really weak. So Lund goes on, we must soberly look at the situation and the world around us and all irrational elements. And all irrational elements is to our disadvantage. We also have to look at ourselves self-critically, and we must recognize that the struggle cannot be allowed to devolve into sectarian, quote, NSDAP orthodoxy, unquote, just because the light from the Third Reich days shines so bright. Such tendencies within our organization must be fought because they are not constructive. We don't want any National Socialist orthodoxy, he's saying. However, we should keep it as an important task to rehabilitate Hitler and give him his rightful place in history. Moreover, it is an absolute necessity to do so. For I think I'm just not going to worry about the time. Once again, I'm going to end up going over time a little bit. I always think I have no reason to go over time, but in the end, I do. And since I started with this, I probably should finish it and do it right, and not rush and have it half done, just in order to finish at the end of 2 hours. So I'll just continue on here. I'm getting into this habit of just not sticking to my time frame, but I guess it doesn't matter a whole lot. So he says, moreover, it's an absolute necessity to rehabilitate Hitler, to be able to defeat our enemies, fighting for his rightful place in history is part of the ideological battle. But that does not mean that we as a political movement should praise him or highlight him in our everyday struggle. We must learn to make this distinction. I'm not sure what he means there, but it seems as though the everyday struggle is about them and what they're doing in their countries and not about Adolf Hitler. So that's probably all right. And we must admit that even Hitler could make misjudgments, and that we as a people who live almost 70 years after his death should not have to defend every action he and his government committed, nor are we in any way tied to the NSDAP party programs or the Third Reich policy. By seeing the errors that the Third Reich committed, we can avoid repeating them. Well, you know what? They won't do nearly as well. The Third Reich did so very well, and I don't think these people have that great of a track record, and I don't think they're as smart as the people in the Third Reich and the NSDAP at that time were, and in Hitler's government. So I think right here, I'll just say that it is my opinion currently that the National Socialist program of Adolf Hitler could be followed almost to the letter although adapted. But I mean, no reason to say, oh, there was so much wrong with it. We'll just use some of it, and then we'll figure out our own the rest of the time, which is seems to be what this the only way you can take what this man is saying. There's no other way. But I don't think that they are that there's anything. I think that the National Socialist Program was so excellent that it could be used, it could be taken pretty much exactly as it is, only, you know, not a different time, different names. I don't, we wouldn't be, probably not the uniforms, but some kind of uniform is a good idea. Speaking of uniforms, one place that we know that uniforms work well is in school. So some kind of a uniform is good in getting people's attention focused on what that uniform represents. And we know that when students, well, I know that when I was in school, we didn't have any kind of uniform policy. And so much energy and effort and concern was put into what you were wearing and what you were going to wear to school that day. And how to have the clothes that you wanted. A lot of people couldn't afford them, didn't have them. Clothing and how you were dressed was this big, big deal. If you have uniforms, that solves all that. And you don't have that, and everybody's dressed the same. It's really so much better. And then you, when you're in school, you should be concentrating on your classes, not on social things. Everything was social. In my experience, too much so. It was oppressive to me. I was burdened by it, that I had to be thinking socially all the time. So if they would work better for school students, some kind of uniform does work better for people who are on a program of accomplishing something. It doesn't have to be a military looking uniform, but people are always complaining, see, about the uniforms. And I can understand that, but anyway, I think I've said enough about that. I'll go on. We must understand that the political map has been redrawn dramatically since World War II. Today, Russia is not communist. Germany is not national socialist. Well, Germany is communist. I mean, Russia is communist. You know, it's not communist, but they're still, like under Putin, I was just talking about it, they're still accepting and glorifying the communist period, except for a few things like Katyn, you know, which kind of messed it up. But they're still acting like the Soviet period in their history was not an aberration, but was just a part of their history and fits right in, and contributed quite a bit to their history, to the history of Russia. So not like in Germany, where naturally Germany is not National Socialist today, and it rebukes National Socialism. But Germany was not a National Socialist until 1933 either. And only for 12 years was it National Socialist. So he goes on and saying, old friends and alliances are no more, and today former friends might be our enemies and vice versa. Well, not that much. It hasn't changed that much. But he might be saying former friends, enemies of the government, and now we might have some friends. What friends? We might have some individuals, like I was talking about, Holocaust revisionists, within these countries that get along with one another, but the country the governments themselves haven't changed any. They're still the same. We cannot use an outdated map and its conditions as a guide. If we do, we will go in the wrong direction. Historical knowledge is something that should give us the ability to understand the present and the future. It should not blind us. You know, when he says this, we cannot use an outdated map and its conditions as a guide. This reminds me of Mark Weber's article on why Holocaust revisionism is no longer relevant. And following a few years later, Greg Johnson wrote his article based on these same ideas of Weber's. You know, I think that's all bull, that it's outdated. Nor should we National Socialists put too much emphasis on states' artificial boundaries. We are neither cultural or ethno-nationalists, although National Socialism evolved from nationalist ideological currents. So he's getting worse and worse here. He's saying they're not even ethno-nationalists. And they don't even care about the boundaries of their nation. He says our loyalty is not currently bound by any particular state. On the contrary, boundaries have always been drawn on and will continue to be redrawn in the future. The geopolitical situation and thus necessary strategies are in a constant flux. So these people are supranational. They're a group of people from several nations, and they're loyal to an ideology, not to their nation. Seems to be what he's saying. And the ideology is National Socialism, but they think that they need to be more flexible with that. So he says if National Socialism is to survive and become competitive in the present and in the future, it must adapt. Is that right? It must adapt. Must it adapt to be competitive? How are they going to adapt it? And you're going to find that in this article, it doesn't give a single idea how it's supposed to be adapted. And I doubt that he follows up on has any ideas on how to do it. All they really want to say is that we don't want to be stuck in some kind of National Socialist ideas that we feel are not attracting people, and what we want to do is attract people. So we'll say that we won't stick with strict National Socialism. He's saying that they can do this, they can adapt it without thereby losing its essence. Well, what is the essence? How do you do that? He says, of course, it is a difficult balancing act. Nevertheless, it is necessary. You could argue that it might be in some ways easier to abandon the frame of National Socialism altogether and call ourselves something else. But that would be weak and defensive, and in practice, it would push us toward liberalization. Wow. He's admitting that they've got a problem there. You know, National Socialism under Adolf Hitler had already, and under its time that it was in power, had already, in a sense, perfected itself. And it worked. You know, it was a total system that made sense. So if you start, he admits here, that if you start messing with it, it could push you in different directions that you wouldn't want to go. And you might be better to just abandon it altogether. And I would say so. If you don't want to stick with National Socialism as it was and as it worked. Maybe, you know, what are these people thinking? Are they saying, well, we can't be so hard on the Jews or something? Oh, well, the eugenics program and the Jewish program and the this and that. Oh, we can't have those. I don't know. He doesn't say that. But, you know, if that's what they're thinking of or whatever they're thinking of. You can't take part of it away and have it still be the same. So you know, I would say they should abandon it and start with something else, but they don't have something else. So, and they know that being National Socialist holds them to something good and strong and that they can, that makes sense. And that is cohesive. So they're afraid, I think they're afraid that, as I already said, that that they're not attractive enough and they're not attracting people. Everybody's concern is how to attract more people. But, you know, I think that the problem with attracting people is with the members, not with the ideology. So to continue here, he says, I'm almost done here. The choice for us is not to choose between liberalism or conservatism in terms of national socialism. Our choice must instead be ideological development. They want to further develop the ideology. Instead of taking a step back in history and choose an ideologically vague concept such as nationalism, we must work to strengthen national socialism as a clear ideology for our time, to make it fit our needs here and now like a living organism evolving or a technology advancing to meet new challenges. That's just blah, blah. That's just high-sounding words, you know. It's a good way to end this article, you know, to make, oh, we got to do this, we got to do that, without any ideas whatsoever. And there's too many people, and I see them here and there, who, when the subject of National Socialism comes up, they insist that National Socialism is not based on race or on anything like that. It's based on behavior and spiritual qualities, and anybody can be a National Socialist. People from other races and non-European and so on. It all depends on if you follow these spiritual qualities and if you have these traits of honor and blah, blah, that nobody has. Anyway, then you're a National Socialist. This is disgusting to me. I don't even get into it anymore or tell them that. I just ignore it. But, it doesn't do any good. But this is not the way it should be looked at. And anybody who looks at it that way is just dead wrong. And not only wrong, they have no business. They have no business talking about what National Socialism is if they don't want it to be what it is, and if they're not even, if they're not German and they're not even European, they have no business talking about what it is. We have to be, so his final paragraph is more of this blah, blah stuff. We must be able to bring about change without rejecting or denying the essential National Socialism. I still don't know why they need to bring about change, but our goal is not to dress our National Socialism up or to replace it with some weaker ersatz ideology. Our goal is to develop the ultimate National Socialism for our time. You know what? They're not going to do that. What's wrong with the National Socialism that was developed for Germany? I've already given my answer to that. This is one of our main tasks at present. However we manage to resolve it remains to be seen. But if anyone can accomplish this without being compromised, it is us. Well, see, now there is this, as I said, people are recommending this article and passing it around. So that doesn't bode well to me. And I just have to say that I am more and more out of step with the majority. I don't know. I would be interested to know what people think about this. It's probably too late to ask for phone calls, so I won't do that. And probably nobody's going to call anyone anyway. But if you would want to write some comments on this or write to me about this, I'd be happy to hear from you. If you're a person who's interested in National Socialism. So I just have a little more, criticism of this man, which I've already given plenty of it, so I don't need to. But this is Klaus Lund of the Nordfront party or the Nordfront organization in Sweden. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the one thing I didn't get to was something about Himmler's death, which is just more about the historical revisionism, the lies that we're told, and how important it is to try to find the truth, which Nick Kolostrum, a British man, is another one who works hard at this. And I don't always agree with everything with him, but I know that he's sincere and he works hard at it. And once again, the overall point of this program tonight is that how important historical World War II, let's just put it that way, World War II and Holocaust revisionism and truth, what's the other word for that? Anyway, accuracy is for Western Europeans, whether they live in Europe or in America, in Canada, in Australia, or wherever. And we can't expect that anybody is going to care about this except us, and it's been shown that that's true, and it's only Western Europeans who have gotten involved in this, and we need to stay involved in it and keep up the efforts that we've made, because eventually we're going to break through on this. There are people still working on it. I mean, we're not done. It's not over with. So keep the faith, and I'll be doing more on revisionism in the future. So thanks for listening tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for staying with me through the end of this program. Let me find my sign-out music. Here it is. And I want to say good night and have a good week. And I won't be doing a Saturday program this coming Saturday, but join me on Thursday with Ray Goodwin for Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour, and then another Heretics Hour program next Monday. Good night.